Hello and welcome to the Chris Allen podcast, brought to you in association with WCRFM, Wolverhampton's local radio station, which you can hear on 101.8 FM, online at wcrfm.com, or by telling your smart speaker to play WCRFM. My guests on this week's podcast are Helen Holloway, who is the Business and Finance Manager at Good Shepherd Ministers, reflecting on their great sleep out and looking forward to their celebrations of 50 years in the city. Dr. Paul Dark will be joining me to talk about the celebrations for Disabled Persons Day. He's an academic, a filmmaker, a broadcaster, a stamp collector or philatelist. You know, let's get it right. Also joining me on the podcast this week will be the chief executive of Wolverhampton Homes. That's Sean Aldiss. And also Julie Hayden, who is the director of corporate services. We're thinking about the cost of living crisis as it impacts on their tenants. And also, what about that mould following the tragic death of Awab Ishaq? Nalin Patel is the volunteer coordinator for the wellbeing walks across Wolverhampton. We'll be finding out how you can join in those and how good for your health it is. Public Health Director John Denley will be giving us more information about the Group A strep, which is concerning many parents at the moment following the tragic death of a number of children. He'll also be talking about the city's lifestyle survey and the health values of the Orange Wolves campaign. And so Helen Holloway is the Business and Finance Manager of Good Shepherd Ministries. And when I spoke to her, I asked her how the sleep out had gone.
It was absolutely fantastic. I think at the moment we've raised just over £50,000.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. I didn't know you were in that kind of numbers, really.
Yeah. I think they had about 140, don't quote me, that actually slept out. This year they actually included children from, I think it was 13 upwards.
Right.
So it's just a different dimension on it. They did art activities. So the feedback has been absolutely fantastic. And each year they do it, it's getting bigger and better.
Sounds good. Now, you said they. Does that mean you dodged it this year?
I did. I've done it the past 3 years. So it was actually Tom Hayden's turn to do it this year.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Yeah, so, no, yes.
get the gaffer in. That's important to the show's an example to everybody as well.
It is.
Now, really important year for Good Shepherd Ministries, your 50th anniversary, and you've got some celebrations coming along, haven't you?
We have. We recently held a mass to celebrate the work of the brothers, but the service that we're really focusing on now is a service on the 15th of December. It's at St Peter's Church in Wolverhampton and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're inviting the whole community, people with a faith, people without a faith. We want to bring everyone together to celebrate the 50 years that the brothers have been working in the city of Wolverhampton.
And you mentioned the brothers there. For those who don't know the origins of Good Shepherd Ministers, just tell us a little bit about them. I know they're real characters and it was a real act of faith on their part in trying to meet the needs of some of the most vulnerable people in our city.
You're right there. It was in 1971 that the brothers had actually come across, most of the brothers originally are from America and Ireland, and a small community of brothers came to Birmingham. And the idea was they were going to start some sort of mission in Birmingham. But they were approached by Wolverhampton and asked if they would actually come and look at doing some work in Wolverhampton. And that's where the seed started. And it started on Christmas Eve 1972. And the brothers started by just dishing out some sandwiches. And it's progressed over time. I mean, most people talk about Thorny Street, and that's when it really started, when they could get a purpose-built building. They could offer rooms for people to stay. And I'm heard there was a delousing room where people would go and be deloused.
Right.
We then sort of went back and we went to Donister Street Church, where we carried on. I think they did that from 2002 and they started again. The project got too big for the brothers. So they went back to the small numbers and just feeding people. We were at Darlington Street from 2002, and in 2019, we came to Good Shepherd, Waterloo Road, right opposite the Molyneux. So the need has always been there. The food is the magnet, the magnet that brings people to us. That is when we can start to support people. We can then start to build a trust. and actually work with them with the issues they're facing. The main thing for us is to work on people's wellbeing, to sort of give them that positive outlook on life and to make positive changes for them.
And I know that the timing of the move was really pertinent, wasn't it? You know, just prior to COVID, and you're able to offer an all-round service to people. But then when COVID hit, the queues down the road for the food services that you were offering.
We opened in February 2020, a 24-hour service, you know, very quickly that had to stop. And we were seeing up to about 1,780 people queue for food.
Incredible.
You know, and I think, you know, the increase went from 120 to 180. All of a sudden, you're catering for those sort of numbers. You very quickly have got to rethink your cooking, how you're going to cook, how you're going to cater for that. So first thing we had to do was buy all new cooking pots to be able to put enough food in for the numbers that we saw. So, yes, everybody, all the staff have worked tirelessly throughout COVID because we were determined not to shut.
Indeed. So you've got a lot to celebrate on the 15th, many, many years of it as well, but also being there ready for when something as big as a pandemic hit as well. So what kind of shape will that service have on the 15th? Who's going to be involved with that?
So we've got the Archbishop of Birmingham, Bernard Longley. We've got Bishop Clive from Wolverhampton coming. We've got the Prior General, which is from St John of God, and he's coming from Rome.
Wow.
We've got various leaders from around Wolverhampton that will take part in prayers. And we've got the wonderful David Wright, who is hosting the service and allowing us to come into his church and sort of have a service which is beneficial to the Catholic organisation, you know, mindful of Church of England, and also very mindful that we want to encourage everyone to come, people with no faiths. So it's got a bit of everything for everyone, but it's just a way for us to, you know, talk, share stories and commemorate the work they've done. And it's really, really good because still now people will come and tell us about their time in Thorney Street and how the brothers changed their lives. And that's powerful stuff.
It is indeed. And from a faith point of view, it's the kind of proof of the pudding, this, isn't it? It's the brother, starting with the brothers and obviously the Roman Catholic origins of this. But you've always served every member of the community, irrespective of background.
Yeah, totally right. Nobody's ever judged. And we're there to support each and every person that comes to us. So, you know, we don't care where people have come from. We don't care that they come to us every day. All we care about is ensuring that they have something to eat and they get the support that they need to improve their lives.
That's Helen Holloway, who is the Business and Finance Manager with Good Shepherd Ministries. Dr. Paul Dark is an academic, he's a filmmaker, he's a broadcaster, he collects stamps, or he's a philatelist, if we want to give him the proper title. And he joined me to talk about the celebrations for Disabled Persons Day. I asked him, what does it mean to him as a disabled person?
It gives a focus to the kind of my life's work, really, which is improving the lot and the status of disabled people. And having a day is a really important thing, to be able to give it a focus to build to and then build from, to keep it in the kind of public eye, to ensure that we are at the forefront of everything that's happening in society and culture.
And you had a day on the first, you had a conference or a get together on that particular day. What was the kind of key things that were emerging? Because this is about accessibility in the arts.
Absolutely. Well, it was in partnership with the University of Wolverhampton, who are probably, along with Wolverhampton Homes, one of the best disability promoters within the city. And it was, they had a whole range of events, and I was on the one in the afternoon about access to the arts, particularly in relation to people with learning difficulties, because they're often, even amongst disabled people, we often exclude them because, you know, that's the tradition. There is hierarchies, as there is in everything. And it's, we're all starting to make much greater moves towards including people with learning difficulties in everything that we do. Outside Centre and Digital Disability have always done that, because we used to promote learning disability shows at the arena 10, 15, 20 years ago. but I think it's becoming a much wider progressive movement of disabled people to be inclusive of a wider group of the various impairments that there are. So, and it's very important that we are embracing all disabled people in a way that we didn't in the past.
And how do we, who are, well, I say I'm able-bodied, I've been going around on crutches for a year, but, you know, normally able-bodied, and although I've learned a lot over the past 12 months, it has to be said, especially in relation to stairs, how do we learn about those barriers, those that we need to break down? How do we learn and then change things? I remember years ago being on, you know, various accessibility courses to learn, and people going around in wheelchairs who were able-bodied, and the abuse they would get as well. So they learnt in that particular way. But how do we learn and then change the way we operate?
Well, I think the key way to learn is to talk to disabled people and equally to listen to when they raise their voice. So there are lots of disability activities. Wolverhampton Homes put on activities, the university puts on activities, the art gallery puts on activities. And it's about non-disabled people going to those things to engage. That's the key. It's about wanting to learn and wanting to make that difference and engaging with them. And there's lots happening. You know, exhibitions, talks, actually all across the city, the colleges. And it's about making the decision to go to them and then listen and then talk to the disabled people who are doing those kind of things. And equally looking at, you know, there's lots of websites, doing your own research. Google's easy. Look up disability equality on Google. There'll be a million things to be able to learn and take away from it. And also look at our website, digital-disability.com, and look at the range of things that we do and explore. I think when I was studying disability like 30 years ago, there was this thing that disabled people are invisible. And I remember one of the fascinating things I discovered, that we're not invisible. We are absolutely everywhere. And the stamp thing, coming back to the stamp thing, that was a key thing, because when I started collecting the stamps, as I did with films, you're thinking, oh, there won't be many. I won't have to spend a lot of money on this. I've now spent thousands of pounds on thousands of stamps that have disability on it, in both a progressive way, in a kind of atavistic way, a not progressive way, but they're there, and it's that collection that's important. Because we are absolutely everywhere. We're across the television. You used to say, "Oh, we're not in films. We're not visible." We are absolutely invisible. But it's about saying we're visible, saying that we're there, and that's the key. And then in getting people to open their eyes to see us. I think one of the talks the university did was, it's titled something like, "Seeing Disabled People for More Than What They Look Like." So it's not just what the visualness of, like, that they're there. It's about engaging with them, talking with them, living with them. And that's the key.
And do you get frustrated sometimes with the images that are around? You know, if I, and again, it's a trivial example, and I don't want to liken me hobbling around on crutches for a year to yourself as someone who's in a wheelchair, you know, permanently. But I remember driving past a garden centre, stupid little thing, and there were people just walking around carrying baskets with flowers in and plants in, you know, as part of advertising the garden centre. I thought, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And does that impact on you? More thick skin now?
I think it does. You never get over oppression and discrimination, which is quite odd when you've had a lifetime of it. You'd have thought that you'd get used to it, but you don't. And it's because it hits you in the oddest and simplest of ways that are often unnecessary. For example, you go to a building, I won't name which one, but like the door that's open is the one that doesn't have the ramp in, and the door that's locked is the one that's ramped. And it's kind of like, why have you done that? It's just irrational and illogical. And it was a simple thing to do. Yet, that's every day if you're a disabled person. Yeah. And it's those minor little things that just take you back. This sounds awful, but major oppression is so constant that's the things you don't notice. It's the little things that suddenly jolt you and you think, oh, I forgot that happens. And it happens all the time. And that's what's really bizarre, how the more trivial it is, the greater the impact.
It sounds there. What you're saying there is that the impact on you are those little things, but actually you've just learned to live with that oppression, and there's no there's no alternative to it. You have to live with the oppression, or it gets you down.
Absolutely, and I think, for example, I know that people go to a particular city, you know, friends like the country and say, oh, it's terribly inaccessible. And I don't think of Wolverhampton as inaccessible, because what you learn to do is you learn to go to the places and go do the things that you know that you can do, that you're not going to be excluded from, or that is going to be difficult. You then don't go to all the things. So you ameliorate the way you live to take account of all the things that are marginalising you. And when you do that all the time, and it's a terrible thing to have to do that, but as a disabled person, you do, to the extent that you don't even think about it. So you only go to the coffee shops where there isn't a step, where there's plenty of tables in the room. You don't go to the coffee shop where there's a little step, but you know it's going to be crowded, there's never going to be a chair available. And that is so ingrained in the way you live as a disabled person that they're the things you don't think about. And it's then these minor things when you go to somewhere new that you don't go very often, you think, oh, yeah. And then that reminds you of all the other stuff that's happening. But and that's what's, in a way, quite surreal as a disabled person.
That's what keeps you sane, really.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. But it is about, so, for example, I know people, and I've seen travel shows about going to Paris, and I remember people saying, oh, it's terribly inaccessible. I love Paris, and I think it's incredibly accessible. Because I've been there so often, I go to the places I don't go to. Yeah. I don't go where I can't go. And it's that whole lifestyle choice that affects you in everything you do.
Back to the stamps. is it true you've got the biggest collection in the world of stamps?
I'm fairly confident I've got the biggest collection in the world, as our stamp website is proving, and the book that we've just done on all the global issues of the International Year of Disabled People's Stamps. Yeah. But they're coming out all the time. And I can't believe anyone else is as sad enough to collect stamps the way I do.
But, as, you know, you've done it, and it was important to do. And probably, you know, with greater awareness over the years, there's been a bit of an exponential rise in that.
Absolutely. I dread an Olympics and a Paralympics because then they bang out so many stamps, it cost me an absolute fortune. The worst year was 2012 when we had the Olympics. They issued stamps for every gold medal winner in the non-disabled Olympics. And I was dreading that they were going to do that for every Paralympic winner. And they did. And I think that was about 55.
I'm going to say, we won a lot of medals.
£3 each as well. So that was a bankrupting moment. So,
you're somebody who's always got something on the go around culture, arts, filmmaking, your latest projects.
Well, the latest projects are the tree planting. We've got this ongoing tree planting thing that we link with the Woodland Trust and another organisation who's unforgivable. I forgot what their name is. And we've worked a lot with Wildside Activity Centre over the years and Spethso Valley. Yeah. And we've just ordered a whole new load of trees. And I would recommend anybody contacts the Woodland Trust because they will give virtually any organisation free trees every year to plant. We always apply for free trees between 50 and 400 and then have a plan to plant them around the city. And so I'd recommend everybody looks at the Woodland Trust website, particularly if you're an organisation, to get trees to plant them. Even if it's guerrilla planting, I'm a big fan of guerrilla planting, a little bit of disruption. So go and plant trees without permission. Yeah. Don't, you know, obviously you can't say that, but I can. Guerrilla tree planting is a great thing.
But you can always ask for forgiveness later.
Indeed, indeed. And then additionally to that, I'm making a documentary with one of the kind of top new academics in disability, a guy called Dr. Mira Griffiths, on disability activism and young people, because for any society to progress, you need young people to be engaged across all things, politically engaged, socially engaged, culturally engaged. And young disabled people aren't as engaged as they should be. And I think that's probably true of most groups. And it's about looking at what you can do to engage more young disabled people in being active politically, socially and culturally, to get across how important they are to society, to make the difference and to continue to make society progress and move forward to being inclusive of everybody. And that, so we actually went to Brussels for that, because there's this group called the Independent European Network of Independent Living. And every other year they have a big march onto the European Parliament and then local parliaments. So we went to Brussels in September and we filmed that which was a nightmare because it was torrential rain, whatever. But it's great, like putting GoPros on the back of people's wheelchairs, you know, in the demo. And then we interviewed a Greek MEP. We interviewed the kind of Minister for Disability in the European Parliament. We're also interviewing a lot of people in England and across Europe. I was in the Czech Republic, so I interviewed a couple of Czech kind of young disabled people about what they're doing. And it's good to see how disability is in this country in comparison to other countries. And we forget how Britain is really, really progressive in relation to disability. We may have taken a few steps back recently, you know, depending on your point of view. But actually, compared to a lot of European countries, people here do get a considerable amount of support. And it's about fighting to keep what we have, to gain more so that we can be more fully engaged in society and to support others to be able to engage more disabled people, which if you engage more disabled people, you engage more non-disabled people and you then build a better society for all.
That's Dr. Paul Dark, and you can find the link to Digital Disability in the show notes for this podcast. Sean Aldiss is the Chief Executive of Wolverhampton Homes, and Julie Hayden is the Director of Corporate Services. They joined me in our Manda House studios, and I put it to Julie, first of all, that many of their tenants will be living in a crisis around cost of living in normal circumstances.
Absolutely, and I think it's a real kind of pertinent question, Chris, to lead us off with. I think what we've seen is almost everyone across the UK is feeling the impact in some way, shape or form from the rising kind of living costs. We've seen inflation around 11%, and that's being driven by some of the kind of spiralling food and fuel prices. And for some people, income is just not able to keep pace with costs and other essential outgoings.
And are some of your tenants in that kind of eat or heat dilemma?
Absolutely. I think what has been really heartening, I guess, for us, for our customers, is to see that people are striving to continue to sustain their rent. We do put out things like rent first messages, and also really importantly messages to ensure that customers know that support is available. So where customers have required support to maintain their tenancy, every effort from Wolverhampton Homes is made via a number of support mechanisms that we have available to us, including our Money Smart team.
I'm going to say the Money Smart team, vital, helping people make the most of what they've got. Sean, tell us about what they do, what kind of advice. I've heard in some other areas where they help people access benefits that they wouldn't have accessed otherwise. And I think, talking to the leader of the council a while ago now, that something like £40 million goes unclaimed in the city.
It does, Chris, and we work very closely with the City of Wolverhampton Council, as you know. And I suppose for me, maximising anybody's income is a priority at this moment, irrespective of how much or how little you earn. And I think there's also a misconception, really, across benefits, because some people think they're only available for people who are unemployed or claiming, you know, universal credit, and it's not the case. And the £40 million mentioned is evidence of it all, yeah, isn't it? But the team, I mean, they're relentless, really, and the support and help they give across our communities in Wolverhampton is just eye-watering. I mean, they give budgetary advice to some of the low-income earners across the city, and it's just amazing. And I think, like Julie mentioned, we just get bowled over with our customers, in particular our tenants, and their will to want to pay their rents, and you know, we just thank them for that. But they also give advice about how to haggle for the best possible prices and the deals out there, right. And you know, some of those best prices and those haggling is done online, isn't it? And many customers don't use the online services, so we'd advise everybody to get out there and get online. There's some help out there for your water bills with Severn Trent. There's a £400 at the moment energy bill support scheme, which we give advice about. Support with your energy bills. You know, we've given over 750 referrals have been given out to some of through our hardship funds and the like to our customers across the city. So please, if you're struggling, don't do this in silence. They give advice about your mobile phone. You know, they yeah, argue if you spend more than £10 a month on your contract, then you should be looking to change that too. And food, you know, I mean, and eating out. And they say, you know, you need to get into Tesco, CAF and places like that and some of the big supermarkets. it's Asda.
Because other supermarkets are available.
Absolutely. And they are available, of course, Sainsbury's and the like. But they give some great discounts.
Yeah, yeah. And we've seen that on the national news. We've seen that and people getting in the warm for a while as well. It's been important, haven't it? You know, I've seen stories from certain parts of Wolverhampton where actually people get on the bus all day, just go round and round and round because it's a cheaper way of keeping warm. So the level of this, and it sounds like your tenants are well covered. So maybe the message, if you're not a Wolverhampton Homes tenant, find someone who is because they can pass on lots of great advice to you as well. And you're going out on the road again with your winter well-being. Now, last time you went on the road, you were serving ice cream. I guess not this time.
Well, it was in the eye to the summer, but unfortunately...
You broke the weather, I remember
I think
that.
We broke the weather. I think it was the last interview, wasn't it? And the ice creams didn't go down too well, I don't believe. But nevertheless, we're going out there. And really, I suppose the point of Julie and myself being here today was really to launch the events that were going to be taking place across this city. We've been working very closely with the City of Wolverhampton Council. You know, when we want to go out there to each of these warm-ups, we want to go out to some of the other hubs across the city and share some of what we're going to be sharing today. And we'd also welcome the opportunity, after we've been around the city, to come back and share with you some of the experiences that we've endured, I suppose, as we do this roadshow across the city.
No, absolutely. You're very welcome to come back. And we were mentioning on the show, the breakfast show I did this morning with Debbie, between 7 and 10, we were going through the number of warm hubs. And there's quite a list now. So people go to wolverhampton.gov.uk and look under cost of living. They can find those there as well. But Julie, going out to people, listening to them, that's your best source of information, isn't it?
It's definitely, for us, it's important. I think this probably, you know, is likened to what Paul was saying earlier, that, you know, you have to listen to the people to know what the people want and need. And that's been a key part of what we've been doing certainly over the last 12 months when we've gone out with our customer surveys. It's really important for us to serve customers as they want to be served. And that's part of, you know, what we're doing in terms of going out and across the city. I think there's a number of ways that kind of customers can get involved with us. The winter wellbeing roadshows that Sean's talked about. And I hope that, you know, you can kind of hear the passion from us in terms of we want to be out there. We want to understand. We want to hear from people. All the dates of the roadshows will be on our website, so residents can come down, they can talk to the teams, they can, you know, talk about anything, keeping safe and well in their homes.
And if you're worried, don't keep it to yourself, isn't it? It's actually, or if you get a bill you can't deal with, don't do nothing.
Absolutely.
Don't talk to
somebody. And, you know, what we say is don't suffer in silence. Yeah. We have the team of Money Smart officers who, you know, Sean's talked about. They're an amazing team of people. Over the last 12 months, we've helped around about 3,500 people. So 750 of those, as Sean said, just since the beginning of October. And looking, you know, what we can do to help and support. You know, we welcome people to get in touch with us.
Turning, obviously, the news has been very much overwhelmed by the tragic death of Awaab Ishaq. Just 2 years old, died in a property in Rochdale, blighted with damp and mould. Now, this obviously has had a ripple effect on of concern with parents, perhaps. And this time of year, the cost of living crisis, the heating, you know, can we eat? This is going to cause a lot of concern, isn't it, Sean? What would be your kind of advice to people generally around how they can perhaps avoid this issue?
I think firstly, Chris, if I may, I mean, the case about Awaab Ishaq has definitely impacted on all of us. And I know I share that much more widely than just myself. I mean, I'm talking about the City Council, ourselves, everybody at Wolverhampton Homes has been deeply affected by this. And so much so, you know, I mean, we've done some consultation just to share with you with our customers on our repairs and maintenance policies. They have been upped to make sure that, you know, we don't actually have much of those issues in the city. Mm. I know we will have, if I'm being honest. And one of the things we've done as a management team in Wolverhampton Homes, we've actually gone back over the last 12 months or more and we've looked at every case that we've had reported and we plan to make a visit to each one of those. We've also set up an individual team, Chris, which will just do nothing else but look at damp, mould and condensation, because we do want to work with people and we know The crisis isn't going to be helping this at all. So we just want to work with people across the city and offer that support.
And it's a general advice. You know, obviously your main concern are your tenants. We 100% understand that. But general, what causes this mould? How does the consultation come in? And what can people do about it generally, apart from obviously if they're one of your tenants, give you a ring?
Well, I mean, the thing is, there are a number of factors which contribute to damp mould or condensation that affect a property and develop condensation, which then develops mould and all the rest of it that goes with it. But, you know, and since the pandemic, I think we've also got to remember that many of us are spending more and more time at home and maybe working from home and choosing not to socialise so much in, you know, pubs, clubs and wherever we used to go. So we're spending far more, too much time at home, I suppose. And the average family, just to share with you, a family of four can actually emanate about 24 pints of water vapour each day.
Oh, no, I read that and I was amazed.
And all that, like, it just like, wow. And this is all going to be going into the fabric of the home. So homes do need to be, I mean, adequately, heated, ventilated to release the water vapour and prevent mold growth. But that's an hard ask, isn't it? If you're saying to somebody, given the current economic crisis, I've not met a soul, by the way, or a person who has not turned their heating down, and that includes myself and the other people who I work very closely with, and that in itself is a factor which can cause condensation. Warm air carries more vapour than cold air.
It's a dilemma here, isn't it? Because people are worried about the heat, so they keep the windows shut and perhaps keep the temperature below 18, which is the sort of recommended. And then if you say, well, open the window, let all the condensation out, but you say, well, I'm freezing now and I can't afford to put the heating up. So there is that dilemma, but the advice is you do need ventilation and you do need the temperature to be 18 plus, really, in terms of centigrade.
You do, and that's a big ask, isn't it? And I think one of the things we want to do is, by the use of these roadshows across the cities, work with our customers, because there are a number of grants which we can help people with. And I think Julie's point, we don't want any of our customers or our communities or our residents of this city. You don't have to be a Wolverhampton Homes tenant, but it's everybody, Chris, this is. Across this city, we want help. You know, we're one city approach. And for me, the message is we do not want anybody suffering in silence.
That's Sean Aldiss and Julie Hayden of Wolverhampton Homes. And in the show notes, you can see some tips with regard to trying to protect your home against mould and condensation. Nalin Patel is the volunteer coordinator for Wellbeing Walks across Wolverhampton. When I chatted to him, I asked him how long he'd been involved in that role.
Yes, I've been doing this for 2 years now, although I've been a walker with the scheme here for 6 years now.
Yeah, and you obviously see both the benefit to you physically, but also the value to other people.
Absolutely, yes. I have a health condition which is helped by walking, and there's no question about the benefits of walking for people with chronic illnesses.
And you've got quite a team of people who support you. Tell us about your team.
Yes, we have about 13 trained walk leaders who man around 10 walks per week in Wolverhampton. But we're always looking for more volunteers to join our scheme. We provide them with training and support.
Right.
So we welcome more volunteers who would want to join our scheme.
It's not, you know, people say, oh, having a walk, that's easy enough to do. But actually, you do need to know where you're going to. Lots of health and safety involved with that. Especially, you said you've got a health condition. I'm not going to pry into what that is. But some people will be walking perhaps as a way of recovery for maybe some serious health conditions.
Yes, we welcome those people and we support them through the walks. As long as they're able to walk, then that's fine.
Now, in city, people say, oh, you want to walk around the city? You don't want to do that, do you? But Wolverhampton's got some beautiful spots, hasn't it?
Yeah, they're all parks. Our walks are risk assessed and they are easy walks, mostly on flat surfaces within park settings. And so they're very much safe rather than walking in streets, you know.
And you've been very frugal from what you're saying to me, that you had some money a while ago, but you're still doing okay. So in these difficult times when there's not a lot of money around to keep things going, you're making the most of what you've got.
Yes, we are. All our volunteers tend to use our own equipment. We work from home and we use our own resources to support this scheme.
Right, and it has massive health benefits as well. Yeah. So what sort of length are these walks?
They tend to be half an hour to 90 minutes. So majority are half an hour, some are 1 hour, and then there's one which is at 90 minutes. And that's the maximum
for
well-being walks.
And people can just go at their own pace, can they?
Yes, they can walk at their own pace.
And I should imagine a bit of a community has emerged from this. Those who walk will look forward to seeing each other. So there's a social aspect to this.
That's right. It tackles loneliness, it tackles social isolation, and people become friends within the group. And so it is a good thing, besides the health benefits of actually walking.
So it's supporting your emotional and mental well-being as well as physical.
Yes, it is, definitely.
Now, you've got half a dozen walks down here on the list, and I'll give the link through on the show notes for the podcast that goes out this week following this show. Right. But you also got a new one starting in East Park.
That's right. 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays at East Park, starting tomorrow.
And obviously you'll expand the walks as you get more coordinators. What's involved in being a walk coordinator?
Walk leader, it needs to be somebody with a little bit of desire to help others. And they need to be able to stand in front of, say, 10 walkers and make a short speech. And besides that, they need to look out for safety during the walk and make sure that all the walkers have completed the walk safely. So and be supportive, really, to the walkers.
Right, and when you're walking, will you be recognisable? Have you got bibs on?
Yes,
or like that,
we have orange-coloured high-vis jackets. All walkers wear orange-coloured high-vis jackets, so it's very easy to spot us.
So if people are around in East Park or West Park or Bantock Park or Springvale Park or Bilton Urban Village or Penderford Walk or Boundary Way Walk, they'll spot you.
They'll spot us.
And then they can come along and say, "Oh, can I sort of find out more?" And so your walk leaders will be able to tell them all about that.
Oh yes, they're welcoming to all the walkers.
And now you've stuck at this, you know, and we have one thing in common today. Both of us have got a crutch because we're hobbling around for various reasons.
Yes.
But you've stuck at this despite obviously some barriers.
Yes, I have arthritis in my knee and I believe that by walking regularly, it helps my arthritis. Some people seem to think that you need to rest, but that's not the approach. The approach is to get the muscles moving in the joints and make them stronger and the bones stronger. So walking is actually helpful to the joints. Very much.
Well, there's the old phrase, isn't there? Use it or lose it.
That's right. Yes, absolutely.
That's Nalin Patel, who is the volunteer coordinator for the walks, the well-being walks across Wolverhampton. You can find out more details about those in the show notes. We've obviously seen in the news the tragic death of a number of children from the Group A strep virus. When I spoke to John Denley, the Director of Public Health here at the City of Wolverhampton Council, I asked him to tell us more about it.
Thanks, Chris. It has got quite a lot in the media over the past week or so, and that's been highlighted by terrible news of 5-6 children dying in 7 days, which if anybody's got children, you'd be very, very alarmed at that case and that rate, really. I just want to kind of, there's elements about being reassured about where we are, but also there's something about being vigilant as well, particularly with our children. So Group A strep, as it's frequently called, is Group A streptococcal infection, bacterial infection that is so circulating in the population anyway. Although this is absolutely nothing new, and there's no new strain of it which I've seen reports of, it's always common within our population group. You and I have been talking over the past 3 years, haven't we, in terms of what's been going with COVID all the way through the lockdown and so forth. The really important thing for us to realise is the behaviour of us as a population has really been interrupted, hasn't it, over the past, you know, 3-4 years, more than we've ever had before, for a lot of time that we can remember. So on that basis, the interruption of lockdowns, people not circulating, then circulating and so forth, it's interrupted the natural prevalence or incidence of a lot of infections. And group strep A is one of those. I'll just let you know for some of the data, if that's okay. I'll just
please do now. Yeah, yeah.
But between 2017 and 2019, the prevalence of group A strep was about 0.5 per 100,000 children aged 1 to 4. So that's 0.5 per 100,000. And remember, we've been on this show before talking about, you know, the rates of COVID being 1,000 per 100,000 at peaks and so forth. So that's something about putting that into perspective. At the moment, that's risen. So that was 2017 to 2019. At the moment, we're on 2.3 per 100,000 for children aged 1 to 4. So if you're looking from mathematics point of view and say, blimey, that's multiplied and multiplied, but it's still very, very low. It's very low, but it doesn't, because the media and where we are, it doesn't allay the fears we've got within the population.
I'm going to say, if you're a parent, then you're going to be worried about it, whatever the numbers are, aren't you?
Absolutely. And that's the thing, really, is to think about, as a parent, say, well, this isn't about, you know, hiding your children away or saying, you know, oh, it shouldn't be circulating. It circulates anyway. It always has done. What we need to do is come back to those key things, really, about prevention. Preventions are actually do what we did during COVID, wash your hands as much as possible, use a tissue, you've got cold and so forth, but also vigilance as well. Keep an eye on your little ones, particularly those under 9. Keep an eye on them and look at any kind of change. If they've had a cold or they've got sore throats and it gets worse rather quickly, or if they get a rash, just to call 111 as quickly as possible. And you can also have a chat with your local GP. If you can't get through to any of those numbers, you can also call your pharmacist as well, just to get that little bit of advice. Right. And that will help keep on top of the worry, but also make sure if you do need some treatment, and that's antibiotics, that's what this is, really. It's a bacterial infection, it's antibiotics, and it should clear up. But if it does get worse, just get some help through the usual channels.
And no, and don't hesitate to ask. Don't feel you're being a nuisance. Don't feel, oh, it's only a cold. Just get it. If you're worried about it, get it checked out. Even for your own, you know, emotional well-being as a parent, get it checked out.
Absolutely. And that's the thing about it. We all worry with our little ones, don't we? Which, oh, blimey, at what point? So the services are there. There's varying different ways of access. All the different health services, pharmacists, GPs, and then we've got the phone lines and websites, all that's got some advice on it, and you've got the opportunity to act.
And you're talking there about, in a sense, about lifestyle, in terms of washing our hands, using hankies, and being very, very careful, but also you've got a survey out for the broader aspect of lifestyle at the moment as well, haven't you? Tell us, what were you trying to achieve from that?
Well, as I said earlier, we've been so significantly interrupted over the past 3-4 years, that I'd say 4 years as well, because we've been coming into somewhere in terms of where we are with cost of living and so forth. So I'm using this as a period too. We make lots of assumptions about the behaviours of our population in terms of, you know, smoking, drinking, alcohol, exercise, mental health and well-being, how worried they are or anxious they are for the future and so forth. But also, what do they think of the city as well, and to improve things? We make lots and lots of assumptions. And about 5 years ago, we did a lifestyle survey and it provided a baseline for us to do something about it. So in this area or that area, these are the things we've got, these sort of rates. And you think, well, actually, we can put something in place. I sincerely believe we have changed in terms of our behaviours. And for us to make the same old assumptions is probably misplaced. So using the lifestyle survey, getting out there and asking our communities exactly what's going on for them and their behaviours, we can maybe put things in place that can support or help alleviate some sort of anxiety, put services in place, which is about treatment, but also advice around prevention. And so far, Chris, it's been really great. We've had about 1,500 people respond already, which shows that actually, you know, people are willing to talk about their lifestyle a lot, which is great. So I'd encourage everybody to please fill in lifestyle service. It will help us make things better for everybody in terms of services, prevention and so forth.
And I'll make sure we put the links out there on the podcast as comes out in the week in the show notes there, so people can ping through as well. Now, I saw your picture this week all dressed in orange because of the Orange Wolves campaign. And this shows the link between, obviously, that's combating violence against women and girls particularly, but also the link to health.
Absolutely. So Orange Wolves, just to link it back to where it came from, really. It's the United Nations annual Orange the World campaign, 16 days of action to end violence against women and girls between the 25th of November and the 10th of December. And yeah, we've been out there in the Manchester Centre all over to raise awareness. And the great thing from this is really a statement for us in terms of Wolverhampton to say, actually, Wolves is an area that we do not stand for that at all. And if it raises awareness, and it raises awareness, it will, one, possibly help prevent it from occurring, but also increase the confidence of those people who are victims of it to come forward and report. So at these times and through these campaigns, we usually get a little bit of an upturn in terms of reporting, and that's exactly what we need. You say, oh dear, no, it's really poor. Our reporting rate's gone up. That's exactly what we want, because we don't want it to be remaining in the background in the city. So fully support it. Get yourselves down to Manda Centre and out and about and where you see the Orange campaign. But yeah, it's going from strength to strength each year, and really great that it's across all agencies in the city. So it's brilliant.
And don't put up with things, you know, if you think, oh, it's only words, people are only saying things to me, that actually anything that makes people feel insecure, lacking confidence, is a violence in another kind of way, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's all different ways, isn't there, really? Undermining, but lack of confidence and so forth can come from so many different routes. So, yeah, violence to women and girls, we're not standing for it in Wolverhampton. To find out more, Orange Wolves, hashtag if you're using social media, and you'll get lots of information.
Indeed, orangewolves.net, or get them there.
.net, there you go.
Cheers, John, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Director of Public Health John Denley. You can find the links from this week's podcast, all the links, in the show notes. If you have any news or information for Rise and Shine on Sunday mornings between 7 and 10, or Chris Allen in conversation every Sunday from midday, then please email me, chris@wcrfm.com. Thank you.